you all for coming here today. As with all stakeholder sessions, this session today will be recorded, and then the recording will be placed on the website. Joe, who's the one who logged you in this afternoon, she had asked that we speak into the microphone because the recorder wants to make sure she captures everyone's voice. So if you can please be mindful of that, I'd appreciate it. And we have enough of them around the table, so if you want to speak, just turn it on to see your own thing. I have a quick presentation here. Well, you can walk here on the spaces. I think there's a seat right there. So my name is Ginger Kopcash, I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Land Use Management Program. I'm running my stakeholder session this afternoon. I want to go around the room real quickly and maybe just state your name and your organization, and then we'll get right down to our PowerPoint.
Okay. Hi, I'm Kim Springer, and I'm with the Office of Policy and Coastal Management.
Colleen Keller, New Jersey DEP Land Use Regulation.
Ryan Anderson, DEP Land Use Regulation.
Tony McDonald, Monmouth University Urban Coast Institute.
Rebecca Hilbert, New Jersey League of Conservation Voters.
Drew Tompkins, New Jersey Audubon.
Jennifer Coffey with AdJack.
Chris Lang, Clean Water Health Center.
Those microphones aren't even on. Just pull it out and turn it on, please. Yeah. Thank you. Joe, can you just pull the microphones out? Sarah Doherty, Waterfront Alliance.
Don Sitzenberg, Hudson Waterfront Conservancy.
Aaron Ford, New Jersey Energy Coalition.
George Burnack, Berkeley Striker Club.
George Brown, Jersey Coast Anglers Alliance.
Clay Arthur, New Jersey Council of Diving Clubs.
Joe Coakley, Surf Rider Foundation.
Ralph Kosha, Citizens Right to Access Beaches.
Rob Ronnie, New York, New Jersey Harbor and Escort Program.
Gil Hawkins, Hudson River Fishermen's Association.
Jeff Fiddle, Sierra Club.
Greg Romano, New York, New Jersey Bay Keeper.
Kathy Bill Sheehan, Mackinac River Keeper.
Anybody Buddy Alamsky, American Liberal Society.
Kim Dillingham, American Liberal Society.
Joanne Davis, DEP Land Use.
Mike Schuett, Division of Law.
Dave Rosenblatt, DEP Climate and Flood Resilience.
So this is one of several stakeholder meetings that we're having on public access. We are meeting with different interested parties, and then we're going to bring everyone together. Now looking more like October, beginning of October, when we'll be able to reconvene. And at that meeting, we're hopeful that we'll have some policies, some language that we'd like to share with everyone. We also have a work group that we have already started to form. I think the email went out, and we're going to send it out to the mayors soon that are participating in the stakeholder sessions. And that's going to be on the permit by rules, general permit by certifications, and the general permits that we are going to be doing that examination of in the flood hazard rules, as well as the coastal rules, and whether we are going to need to do an individual public access assessment on those different permits. And perhaps a determination that some of those permit by rules, general permits by cert, have to be moved up to the general permit status so that they can have an individual screening. But I'm going to quickly go into this presentation. The goal here today is not really to listen to me speak. It's really to get feedback from you all on the legislation and some of the things you are seeking to have put into our rules. So as I mentioned already, we are stakeholdering. The goal here is to have a rule proposal out for winter 2020 with an adoption in the winter 2021. This timeline is consistent with the legislation, which is an 18-month timeline. As you all know, rulemaking, if you've ever gone through this experience, it generally takes about a year from proposal to adoption. So in this case, we are cutting down the proposal to adoption timeline to afford us more time during the stakeholder and rule writing portion. Hopefully get the rule as in the best shape that we can to perhaps maybe address some of the concerns up front as opposed to during the rulemaking process. So our goal here, I think I'm gonna stand up. So our goal here is to incorporate the legislation into our rules. Probably the biggest change here, not hugely huge change, is the legislation clearly defines the standards that apply to a marina, clearly define what are the suite of projects that we cannot consider on-site access for, and then incorporates parking and restrooms into additional amenities that are could satisfy your public access requirement. The rules, this is in our current set of rules, as well as the legislation, public access includes both physical and visual access, as well as perpendicular access to access the water and supportive amenities, as I just mentioned, including parking and restrooms. Parking is pretty big for us. We had in our last rulemaking, we were very careful about how we added parking. We were warned pretty well by our Attorney General's office that we really didn't have a lot of authority to ask for parking. But I think we did it under the guise of it's needed for fishing. So we saw that as a big win in the legislation. So the legislation is also real clear here. If you're changing the footprint of a existing development, and that triggers a need for one of the coastal permits that we have, or a flood hazard area approval, or if you're changing use, you need to do, for an individual permit, you need to do this individual public access assessment. Kind of everyone refers to it as a Matthews test to determine if additional access is needed. And for beach and dune maintenance, as well as beach replenishment, you're going to need to be doing a public access assessment. So our goal today, and I'm going to stop it right here, the presentation, because I want to go around the space and get everybody's input. What we really want to gather out of these sessions are, I always call it like the line in the sand. What are the things that you really would like us to incorporate into the rules? What are some things you don't want to see in the rules, perhaps? If we can start there at the extreme ends of what you really want and what you don't want to see, that would, I think, be very helpful to us to understand your individual perspectives. Well, I'm going to start here with Tony.
I don't have anything in mind. I'll probably point you out a little bit before I considering really how the extent to which community planning, public access plan, community plan can anticipate these needs so that it's not so much driven by the individual permit regulations. So my more overall concern is how this links more to existing communities so that they can plan for this and work with the communities so that we can, to the extent possible, avoid these site-by-site specific debates about access.
Okay, and I'll just say, so we recognize that this is a multi-pronged issue. We can't satisfy public access permit by permit.
We need to make sure that we have a more holistic approach to it. I think that there was an attempt at it with municipal public access plans. If anybody's seen those public access plans, they're a little underwhelming when you look at them. they're not really kind of hitting what I think we all envisioned would happen or we wanted to see. But we recognize in our coastal zone management program that we need to do more to build and establish more public access. But this session is really about the rules with respect to if somebody needs a permit, what we're going to need to look for in that individual permit assessment for public access, okay?
I guess, so keeping in mind what you just clarified, like NJLCB, like you're saying, is more on the broad support for public access. So we're willing to hear what we would need to do to clarify the permit system, but we don't have any necessary specific comments in regards to that right now.
Similar statement for New Jersey Audubon. Nothing specific right now. Monitoring changes, ensuring that wildlife is looked at throughout the entire process, in addition to supporting general public access to tidal waterways.
Okay, can I just ask you a question?
What do you mean by wildlife is looked at? Are you talking about making sure that we don't allow access at locations where there's critical wildlife habitat or?
So yeah, just ensuring, as the rules come out, watching to make sure, especially T&E settings, that we're not changing or in any ways impacting those habitats to the greatest extent possible, of course.
Okay.
But we can, you know, following current regulation, make sure we're not impacting that the current rules in the way the DEP is protecting those areas.
Okay.
Jennifer Coffey from AJAC. Again, I would concur with the previous comments, and we don't have specifics today. We were here to listen to what other folks had to say, and we'll be providing you with additional information as we move forward here, should we hear from our constituent municipalities on this issue.
Chris Lang, Clean Water Advocacy Center. I think it's good what you're saying about the need to look at DEP's permitting, because that seems to me to be how you are empowered to provide public access. So what I think needs to happen is that you need to marry the statute's requirement for your sort of maximalist public access requirements by looking at the rules that would be required by statute but have been relaxed in terms of their procedures. So I'm happy that you're looking at permits by rule and other sort of permits that are given without any real reflection by the department. Those, I think, can be interpreted to still require access requirements. And so I think that you can adopt a more maximalist position about ensuring public access by looking through all of the oversight that the department has ceded over the years, I think in many cases appropriately, but reclaiming that so that public access can be required in situations where a permit by rule allows somebody to act without a particular specific application.
Sarah Doherty from the Water Alliance, here representing Access Task Force that we convened of New Jersey and New York organizations some in this room. I think that based on feedback we heard, first just recognizing there are lots of groups that have been working on this for a long time, so working with them to develop the rule. Second, incorporating resilience into the rulemaking, so in conjunction with the Coastal Resiliency Plan. The Waterfront Alliance also has a framework called the Waterfront Edge Design Guidelines. So that might be a lens for looking at how implementation of new public access or restoration of public access is resilient, accessible, and sustainable.
Tom Sitzenberg, Custom River Waterfront Conservancy. Two specifics. One concerns properties that are in violation of PDD now, and a rule needs to be added whereby the DEP will look at a property and determine whether there is either a PDD violation or at least an indication that there might be. Properties that do not submit permits and never submit permits cannot be excluded from the rules, by looking just at permit submissions, because there are properties out there that, that need to be assessed. Second one is on the other end. There are properties along the waterfront that already have a public access easement going back to the 80s and the 90s. Those easements are obsolete, don't meet the current standards, and actually are an inhibitor for the DEP enforcement group, because they actually provide opportunities for property owners to point to them and say, you are not able to enforce that because it's not in my easement. We need a rule to allow what I call second generation access approval that looks at the old one and either modifies it or replaces it with an updated public access easement. Thank you.
So can I just pause with you for a second? So if an applicant is coming into us, what you're looking for is a refresh on the public access review that is done, even though they may have existing access, you want them to improve it to the standards in the new law.
What I would like is not a refresh, but a complete reassessment, as though it were as though there were no access easement. So start over with the current standards and hold the developer to a to whatever the current standards are, whatever the current rules are. It is complicated by the fact that the old easements run in perpetuity, and so there are legal issues involved with it.
Okay. Eric Ford, New Jersey Energy Coalition. I just had to say, I look and I wonder, has it impact critical infrastructure in those areas? And that's just my first assessment. Looking at that, just if there's something in the area when it comes to that, critical infrastructure. So, if there's something in that area,
yeah,
that's my first thought in there.
George Vernick, Berkeley Striper Club. Speaking really mostly for myself, and the area that I fish is the area that's recently gone under the dune replenishment. And over the years, I have seen what I consider improvement in the area in terms of providing public access, because now places that used to have no trespassing signs every once in a while have a public access. But you referred to it earlier. There are many areas where that doesn't help because there's virtually no place to park. So that's my addition for today.
George Brown, JCAA. I'd like to pass this up to the front. I will go through this briefly. When we start looking at discussions of public access, it's multifaceted. There's existing places where there are covert and overt ways to deny access to the public and for a lot of different activities, and then there are future projects that may be coming down the road. What I gave you there is a short, brief overview of several locations that I was able to go to, and I was able to verify the facts, take some photos. I'm not going to go into great detail of it, but you can see places like Pine Beach on the Thomas River. The access to that, the river is restricted due to terrain. There are three public fishing piers there. Every one of those piers requires a beach pad to fish or crab. Anytime you are on the pier, you can only purchase the beach patches 9-4 in Borough Hall. So if I wanted to go on a weekend and I didn't have a beach patch, I would be restricted from going there. They do provide good on-street parking. Anything that is off-street parking requires you to also obtain a separate parking permit. The thing that I find most interesting about it, though, is as we go through this little bit of, some of the photographs here, we get to the pier, the Farragut Pier. That was built by Green Acres, yet I can't go on that pier. That was built with public money. The land was acquired with public money, yet if I want to go out there as a senior, it's going to cost me $5 for a badge, and I have to go 9-4 during the week. So if we start looking at access, we see a lot of municipalities are very, very guilty of denying public access. South Seaside Park, I live in Berkeley Township. South Seaside Park put parking regulations into the 1990s in response to complaints about wind surfers. So what they did is on the west side, which is the bay side of the street, they banned parking. The east side, you cannot park because of the fact that there's driveways and there's homes there. And there is parking on the side streets, but we're in a situation where it's adversarial. If you pull up there to use the bay. Going through a little further, it gets more egregious as you go through some of these. Seaside Park requires, if you're fishing or crabbing, you're required to beach bench at any time that you fish from the piers, or in case of the what they call the wharf at M Street in Lake Avenue, which is really nothing but an extension of the sidewalk, you have to have, anytime you go there to fish, you have to have a beach bench. And you have to go to someplace and get a beach bench. So, you know, that's, we're looking at, these are some of the covert and overt ways that they restrict access. Island Heights requires you to have a bench 24/7, 365 days a year. Anyone aged 6 or over, not 12 or over, but 6 or over, and it's $20 to $35 for a season badge. And, you know, if we're going to offer a discounted badge for early purchase, that tends to favor the residents as opposed to people coming from out of town. So there's a way that, you know, you're giving preferential treatment to residents. The last one, the last two I want to talk about very briefly is the one in Brielle, which is Osprey Point Drive. Osprey Point Drive is very, very expensive homes. There is a Google map shot of it showing where it is. There is, at the end of Osprey Point Court, I believe it is, there is a public access point, Osprey Point Drive, there's a public access point right there. It's on the DEP website. They have prohibited parking on that street and all the streets in the area. If I want to go and I want to fish Osprey Point Drive, I want to go to the public access, or I want to drag my kayak down there, I cannot park in that street. And there's a photo of the Coast Star article in which Councilman Frank Caruso says, he's quoted, parking is prohibited to, quote, make it palatable for people who live there. You know, I mean, that right there says already we're going to begin discriminating against people. And then he goes on to say, if residents of Osprey Point are having an event that needs on-street parking, they can call police and notify them. With the intention being, I can't park there, it's not a counter, but if you live on that street, and you've got people coming over, we call the PD, they're going to ignore the no parking restrictions. That is a overt attempt to block people from having public access. And I also have unconfirmed reports that the gate to the public access has been locked at times. I couldn't park to go looking for the gate, so I didn't find it. And then that leads us to future projects. And the future project I'm talking about here is one that is planned in Atlantic Highlands. It's in the very early stages. When you look at the overview, and I put a larger overview of the project, you will see a couple of things. One, there is no dedicated point of access. There is public spaces provided. And they also look at a stone revetment, which is where the public space would be bayside at that. So with sea level rise or high tides or whatever, what's going to happen to that access point? There is no parking plan for public access to this location. There is talk of maybe one access point, not a through access, but an access point on the west side. This is kind of a facility that should have both a west side and an east side, so there's complete through access, whether I park in the Atlantic Highlands or I park in the public space. There needs to be an adequate number of parking spaces, and we need proper walking services. These are all ways that municipalities go, and they make it so that you cannot access the beach and get to the beach, whether it's fishing or walking or whatever. But these are the overt, covert ways that these towns go, and they block access. What's interesting is, though, you know, looking forward to the future, what we like to see from the DEP, we know that public access problems are pervasive. We see them everywhere. The folks from the Hudson River, the people from South Jersey, I hear it constantly. I can't get good hard facts on it because a lot of people don't want to talk about it, but we know that the problem is pervasive. The denial of access, as I said before, is both overt and covert locations, and the typical covert methods include, you're going to limit my time. If I'm going to Manalopi and I want to surf in Manalopi, I can find a couple of streets to park in, and they're going to limit my time that I can park. So that means I've got a very restricted window when I can take advantage of public access. Or requiring beach fees at all hours. You know, we're not going to get away with beach fees. We do away with beach fees. We know that already. The simple fact of the matter is, if you cannot provide me any services such as lifeguard services, don't charge me for beach, or don't require a beach badge with lifeguards right there. Or if you say I have to have a beach badge, then you need to make it available to me at a time that is reasonable. About 10 years ago, Seaside Park was cited by the DEP because they had turned around and they'd only sell day badges at the most northern beach in Seaside Park. The intent of that was to restrict or limit the access to the beach to people who are coming to Seaside Heights, the day trippers, who they didn't want. DEP came in and required them to sell day badges at several other locations. So you need to make beach badges. If you're going to require a beach badge, it's got to be available to be purchased. And the way we look at it is DEP needs to provide leadership. You know, this is 30-some years ago when Rich Shapiro was the was a deputy public advocate. We had a public advocate's office. Rich went and he fought the case from Bayhead. We got access in Bayhead. We don't have those people out. We don't have a public advocate right now. So we need people to provide leadership. We should be providing these municipalities with model ordinances to adopt to provide access. Somewhere in there has got to be a model ordinance. I looked at Ocean Gate's plan, their access plan, and they provided an awful lot of access. And it's a little tiny community. We need to have an updated inventory of the existing public access points. Some of them don't exist anymore. So that is sitting out there that needs to be updated. We also need to look at them, and maybe we get citizen volunteers to come in and go check those locations to see if there's a fence, to see if they've taken the signs down, to see if they've planted shrubbery in front of these locations. And the biggest thing we need to do is educate the public and elected officials on what their rights are in public access and what public officials have to provide to accommodate those rights. And the last thing we really need from DEP is we need enforcement of what's out there already. If somebody files a complaint, I don't want somebody trying to get it off their desk. I want to see real follow-up. I want to see feedback on it. I want to be able to track that and see have things changed. And as everybody said, there's a lot of stakeholders in this. There is common ground in here that we can find where I think we can accommodate pretty much everybody's needs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hard act to follow.
Yeah.
Ed Glenn Arthur, New Jersey Council of Diamond Clubs. I'm also here representing citizens in opposition to beach restrictive access culvert. Remember what he said. We're looking for enforcement and penalties. Mm-hmm. I have a situation at Lake Tackenacity. I've been watching it for the last 4 years. It's only been this year, in the 10th year of their CAFRA permit, that they finally installed a sidewalk access as they were required to under the permit. Finally, in the 10th year of two permits that they've had, they're on their first renewal, and they've already got a building that's done. The permit said at the start of construction. Hasn't happened. Oh, finally, 10 years later, it happens. Oh, yeah, by the way, part of the paragraph in that access point being constructed is 5 parking spaces. Now, I haven't been there in about 3 weeks. 3 weeks ago, they didn't exist. To my knowledge, no one's seen them. We've got a situation in Elberon Deal where if I have my way, both towns will be paying a little bit more money when the pumps come back to put more sand on the beach, because there is a more than half mile section between Elberon and Deal that has no access for the public. There is an easement at Garfield Road, unfortunately, that's strictly a deed easement for fishermen. And even that access is restricted with a gate that is on occasion locked, actually more often than not. And it says on their little sign on the gate that they have to register with the Homeowners Association. Now, I don't know of any rule in the New Jersey Administrative Code or any statute that's ever been passed that says a fisherman has to register to use a deeded easement. The other things I'm looking for would be, again, enforcement penalties. What are the penalties for violating any of these rules? I've never seen any. I've never heard of any. Oh, yeah, there was one on the Poplar Brook that our Cobra group got a picture of a dump truck dumping into the ocean. Supposedly it was $7,000 a day. I've yet to be able to track whether or not that was ever paid. They were fined 2 days. Having the enforcement and the penalties, you now have a statute that allows the rules allows you to write the rules legally and have them stick. We need to have them enforced and penalties applied so that these people know that, yeah, if I try to get away with something, I may end up paying a penalty. But again, it's a municipality. The penalties that they pay don't come out of their personal pockets because they have qualified immunity. The money that they pay in fines comes out of all of our pockets because it's tax money. You have a situation in, again, Deal. They're trying to sell up another street end. That's in court. More taxpayers' money being spent, as well as certain nonprofit organizations spending their money on lawyers. You have a situation, again, in Deal, where they use a state grant to create land, 70-something feet by 100-something feet. And now they're appraising it to sell it to the adjacent property owner. That's money that you all spent in your tax dollars for a town to sell to a private property owner to add to their property. Now, that's technically, I'm sure, legal, but it certainly isn't law. You have several other towns that are in the process of or have already sold sections of the bay and street in North River. Seabright's an example. They sold off a section of property so the gentleman could extend his deck. These things need to stop, or we will have no more public access, even though we have now a statute after what this started back in the 1990s when the beach replenishments first started. I saw back then, I was able to somehow find on the internet a document of a previous task force from back in 1995 that did nothing. It took this group of people and how many meetings and years to finally get this statute done. We need the DEP to sit up, take notice, and actually do something with the rules. You now have the authority. You don't have to worry about the Superior Court anymore. Hopefully, we need some teeth put into the rules. Thank you.
Joe Coakley, Sir Brighter Foundation. I'd like to think of what these guys said. I think it goes beyond the permitting process. I think municipalities need a hard and fast direction on what their responsibilities are in terms of public access. You know, and echoing the fishermen, surfers in most cases have to pay a beach badge fee just to conserve. Not even, you know, there are times that I'm not going to sit on the sand, I'm not using a lifeguard, I'm surfing in a surfing beach. But I still have to have a beach badge to go on the sand. I think that recreating activities like that should not be subject to having to pay when you're not using the amenities that towns are charging for. And further to that, it's the DEP's responsibility to enforce and to educate. We've had several complaints and situations where we have private beach clubs that are trying to throw people off of sand that doesn't belong to them. Again, this should be all addressed to where they get something. The beach club gets something from the DEP saying this is what your rights and responsibilities are under the new law. I'm sure we're going to have more as the meetings go on, but that's kind of where we're at right now.
Ralph Gosha, Citizen Right to Access Beaches. I always start any conversations that I have with people basically by saying, I represent the people that just want to go to the beach. And there are just so many impediments to beach access, some that you can control or you're going to be able to control, and some, of course, you cannot. I agree with everything that's been said so far. I think we're kind of working at a situation where we're trying to close the barn door after the horse gets out in a lot of cases. A lot of it has to do with private beach issues that I see every day in Northern Ocean County, where people have had, built very expensive homes on the beachfront, looking at the ocean as their own private swimming pool, and anything between their home and the water is there, fights them, and they, you know, they control everything. And I think that's probably where your rulemaking will have to kind of get more involved. I definitely agree with the enforcement issues. We need to know who we can contact when there's an enforcement issue or enforcement problem. I believe that, again, with the new rulemaking procedures you're going to have, you might have a little bit more control over things. And the other very important thing is education. We need to educate the property owners, the municipalities, the police that are called in to right now be the enforcers of any of these issues. And anything that we can do to help out, we certainly are available for you. Thank you.
Hi, Rob Cronin from the New York, New Jersey Harbor and Estuary Program. So my comments are really focused on northern New Jersey, you know, Ritter and May up on the north and between the Hackensack, Passaic, and Hudson River. So understanding what you guys mentioned about how the rule is really focused on the individual, this hearing is focused on the individual permit as opposed to the municipal public access plans or more broader regional goals, I do want to make sure that as you go forward with the individual permits that you recognize that so much of the success that you're going to have on the individual permits comes down to the context of those individual land use decisions and building, whether it's flexibility or guidance or mechanisms to ensure that those individual permits are those decisions are made in those contexts. So, and I just want to highlight three specific reasons why. One is connectivity. So when we're talking about our urban waterfronts, whether it's Hudson River Waterfront Walkway or the Hackensack Walkway, you know, those public access, the provision of public access in those places are really, the value of that is really multiplied when they're connecting with their neighbors and folks can traverse across those waterfronts and connect maybe to a larger public park that's down the road. And so building in some flexibility, building in guidance that encourages folks to do that, I think would be paramount, you know, standing up specific authorities similar to the Hudson River Waterfront Walkway Act to do that on other urban waterfronts around the state would be terrific. Second is that we know that access in those urban areas, access to the water, you know, there's a real hierarchy between visual access and access to the shoreline and access onto the water. And I think you want to recognize that folks who are able, in the context again of the permit, provide access onto the water for small boats or programming or whatnot is really value added for the public, and you should recognize that. And then third, and just echoing what's been said all around New Jersey on enforcement, we know that a lot of these private landowners, you know, even if they have the best intentions as developers, you know, or as landowners, you know, they're not in the business of providing public access. So in those urban areas, if there's a way to incorporate incentives for them to fund private sector stewardship of those public spaces, programming of those privately owned public spaces, or even deeding that property over to a public parks, whether it's state or local, I think is something you should explore. New York City added that provision into their coastal waterfront plan. And, you know, it's met with limited success, I would say, but I think the intention is clear, and they've certainly stood up a number of public-private partnerships to kind of encourage programming of those privately owned public spaces, because, again, you know, these folks, you know, they're not in the business of welcoming the public, and they never will be, in my sense, you know, so you really want to get somebody else in there whose job it is to make that successful. And then last but not least, again, somebody else mentioned this too, is, you know, clearly with sea level rise, you know, the state needs to sort of add in conditions that sort of understand that with sea level rise, with greater incidences of flooding, you know, people are going to be making those kind of changes to the waterfront, whether it's berms or other kind of resiliency measures. So any measures you can take an individual permit to acknowledge that would be critical. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Gil Hawkins, Hudson River Fishermen's Association. So I have a couple of stories because everybody is giving long lists and these are wonderful lists. George, incredible work, everybody. So a guy comes to the waterfront. Doesn't make any difference where it is. Tidal waterfront. Could be Edgewater, could be Deal, could be somewhere else. And he's got two little kids, and his wife, and a cooler, maybe some bait and a couple of fishing rods. And I guarantee you that he can spend probably a good part of a weekend trying to find a place to get close to the water where he can actually smell it and taste it and put his feet in it. Second story. How many people here know of a lake in New Jersey called Lake Hopatcong? Raise your hand if you know where that is. A good portion of the people here know of Lake Hopatcong because of what's happening with the algae in that lake. An incredible educational process happened within the last 2 weeks to let the public know that there was no access because of health reasons to Lake Hopatcong. And yet not one of you here really knows what access means in tidal waters in the state of New Jersey. That's what we're trying to define. And yet we're looking at all of these things and we're not really understanding that the basic concept is to get people to the water and allow them to enjoy the water. And how does that happen? Well, right now it's a whole bunch of negatives. You can write a whole encyclopedia for Tampa if you remember those books. Of negatives. But we're not talking about that. We should be talking about the positives. We should be talking about how great, you know, New Jersey is in terms of the shoreline and how great the fishing is in New Jersey. We should be promoting that and making people want to come to the community along the Jersey Shore, the Passaic River, places like that. Spend time smelling that water, putting their feet in that water, and we're not doing that. That's what access is about. Access is about education. And if you want to go the other direction, you can say yes. If somebody's abusing that access, then we should be able to enforce the rules and laws that we have, because then we're denying other people access. But what it really comes down to is, if you want to talk about permits, here's a permit. What we should be doing is talking to kids in school. What we should be doing is talking to the municipalities, the ones that are always turning around and putting up the parking signs that say 1.5 hour or 2 hour parking. It should say, parking for access to the waterway. The fear is, what happens if all these people come down to the waterway? What happens if all these people come to the beach? What happens to all the fact that all these people are now fishing and recreating and having a wonderful time? What happens? We're not looking at that. We're looking at how we can keep people alive. Thank you.
Jeff Timola, Sierra Club. I think for me, when we're looking at what should be in a rule, is that we need to have very clear and enforceable standards. Without that, I think we cannot do proper planning. The good towns will do the right thing, but the bad towns need to see what they should be doing. And I think that's critical. And we should be tying it to permits in a way that helps to not only gain new access points, but to help make up some of the sins of the past, as also to spending and grants as well. I think it has to be interrelated. If you're going to get money to improve a park, you should also be requiring access, or at least putting in an access plan that can be at some point implemented. There needs to be a little bit of flexibility, because in some cases there may be towns that have a commuter parking lot or something else, or a town hall that could be used on the weekends for parking or access, but I think the clear thing is enforceable standards, and I think we should go back to what we used to have, require access every half mile. And to me, that would be the first step. We also, besides looking at parking, we need to look at ingress and egress, because there are places where the parking may be so far away, you can't even, you know, drop your kids off, you know, because you've got to park so far away, or council play games and trying to do a lot of one-ways and dead ends and get rid of streets to try to prevent that access from happening. So we need to look at that as part of it as well. And I know you mentioned bathrooms, but changing the areas are also important to be tied to that, because, you know, a lot of beach towns don't let you change in the bathrooms, don't want one of them. So again, you know, if you're coming with a family and you've got kids, you know, you need a place for the change. You can't go into a bathroom if they don't let you, they prohibit it, or you have to try to do it in a stall, which is very uncomfortable or whatever. But I think changing has been part of it, and other amenities as well. Also, when we towns have these beaches that become the access beaches, that they're not the beaches that have no beach or go underwater every day at high tide, which some towns have also played those kinds of games with. So we really need to, as I said, clear enforceable standards, real guidances, and do it on a broad range. Otherwise, I think, you know, we'll go back to where we were, or where, you know, where we're towns can keep blocking access. The other thing, you know, listening to people about, you know, because of resiliency projects, is another side of it, that access in the state may expand to new areas because of sea level rise and tidal changes as well. There will be areas that will actually now become tidal and brackish that weren't. So we will be looking at access there. And my last point is, I think we really need to look very clearly in the urban areas with redevelopment to require access. It's had, and also with brownfield cleanup, and that we have a lot of places that are still going to be cut off from the waterfronts that are going through new developments or are getting cleaned up, and there really needs to be a real tie into the urban front development to those two things. Thank you.
Craig Ramone, New York, New Jersey Daykeeper. Like all legislation and regulations, we all know the success, key to success is in the details and in the technical issues. We've had the benefit of being able to provide DEP with comments in this area, and we'll continue to do so. But with a few minutes here today, I'd just like to refer to a few other things along those lines. First, I want to acknowledge Chris Lang and thank him in this forum, because Chris was the one who successfully litigated the Hackensack Riverkeeper and Baykeeper lawsuit that went a long way to getting us in this room today, and the law passed. So that's a nice thing to happen. Baykeeper is very interested in the Irving Coast and the bulkheads. Unfortunately, we lost a huge opportunity to get more funding into those areas. There weren't nearly as many voices there when the fight was tough a couple of years ago, and we could have been able to get certain facilities that won't have to pay in this law to contribute to public access off-site, but that was lost. Good thing happening is ALS and the fishermen and the surfers and the public access folks and the divers have been working really hard and sharing information. And this may be the one and only time I ever say this, but I wish Ray Camper was in the room, because both as DEP, at DEP and with the Business Administration, in commentary, public comment, Ray talked about all the public access points we don't need anymore because so many exist. And between all the folks that you've heard today, between a lot of work that ALS and Bill and we've all done, Baykeeper's been going out looking at sites. There's a lot of those sites that are listed as DEP public access sites either have no signage, have no parking signage, have overgrown, so you have no way of accessing. We're field checking those. And so that's something that we imagine, and I think was covered in a lot of what you said, but want to make sure we'll provide that information, that those sites that are listed but really don't fulfill the purpose of public access are upgraded and have signage and have facilities and have clear pathways. And then I think everybody else will echo this, we're all echo what everybody else has said, is that we're going to keep coming back to all this if we don't have strong enforcement penalties. We've worked on this for many, many years. And if folks don't feel that there's any penalty at the end of the day,
they go ahead and do it, and then we all have to work really hard and then come to you and press DEP and go through it all again. So appreciate the work that you've done so far and look forward to continuing working with you. Thank you.
All right, well, everybody's been saying a lot of the things that are on my mind, but one theme that's been running through the table ever since we got over here has been the need for enforcement. And I can tell you that there is this dire need for enforcement. There were sections of walkway that were built as part of land use permits that are now locked. They have gates and padlocks on them. You know, back in the 90s, when, you know, Riverkeeper was brand new to the scene and Baykeeper was working on this and ALS was working on it, we had a guy at DEP who used to actually come out and field check these places. Bill Ninehouse was the greatest asset that you had when it came to public access. And he didn't only work 5 days a week for you, he worked 7 days a week for you, because I worked on weekends with him, reviewing spots along the Edgewater waterfront, reviewing spots along the Hackensack River waterfront. And we don't have that type of enforcement now. There's nobody there. So the Nissan dealer, for instance, in Hackensack, they were required to build a walkway, or which is planned to be a contiguous walkway for the whole city. And they built it, and then they put a big, like 10-foot high fence around it, and a gate with a lock. So you can stand in the lot next door and look at that access, but you can't get onto that access. And the lot next door has not been rebuilt yet, so there's no real access there either. You know, it's just a question of walking to the back of the parking lot and seeing the river. And we need to fix these things. There's been cases over the years that every single time that it's come down to it, they've always ruled in favor of the public. They've always ruled in favor of the public's right to access the tidal waters of the state. That's what we're asking for. We want that access to be fair. We want it to be equitable. We want people from all over the state of New Jersey and, you know, basically all over the region to be able to access our beaches, to access our rivers, to access our bays and our harbors. That's where the action is. And we're losing people from the boating industry. We're losing people from the fishing industry. We're losing people all the time because it's becoming harder and harder and harder to go out there and just do those things, you know? And we gotta fix that. The state of New Jersey is a coastal state. It's one of the, you know, it's been my birthplace. I've been living here all my life, and it's, you know, I can remember having to drive back in the 50s and the 60s on the old Garden State Parkway. It would take 3 hours to get down to a place where you might want to put your body in the water. Now we've got water, we've got relatively cleaner, much cleaner water in the Hackensack, much cleaner water in the North Bay area, much cleaner water throughout northern New Jersey. And people are still tied to their steering wheels every weekend in the summer trying to get to the beach. When, if we had adequate public access in places like Jersey City, Bayonne, Hackensack, Weehawken, if we had that, people would be able to stay home, save a lot of money, save a lot of aggravation, and maybe grow a relationship to their water, because that's one of the biggest problems. The reason people got away with so much crap on the waterfront is because people were divorced from them. When people were invested in those waterfronts with their own time, with their children, with their, you know, with their recreation, with their ability to just get there and relax, you're going to have a lot more demand for that type of access. And if you're not in a position to do it, the only way you're going to be in a position to do it is through enforcement, because you can be nice to these people all you want. But the truth of the matter is, the only thing that a lot of them understand is a court order. And that's, you know, and we don't want to have to go to court over and over and over again. We won this case. This case was clearly decided. Let's do it right this time. we don't want to wind up back in front of the base court.
So first, Ginger, thanks for having this, having your staff, what you said from the department here. I think, you know, you hear a lot of folks' comments, and every year we have some rule in this law being passed, sort of their expectations, right, as to the change in the way the state, not just the department, but the state approaches public access. And as we all worked on this bill, it was long, and we tried to, one, respond to places where the department in particular had not been given the authority by the legislature, so the Avalon decisions about parking, try to have the legislature clearly articulate that the department had a responsibility and a duty to deal with impediments to public access, whether those are physical or institutional, so it's parking restrictions, the nonsense that the towns have come up with around fees, those types of things. And they clearly try to provide some tools outside of the regulatory process, not to diminish that, but the idea that now funding that comes through the department or is federal in origin and touches on activities that might be regulated by the department needs to be reviewed against this law and this trust doctrine was an idea trying to get beyond simply, you know, the use of a regulatory program to effectuate really strong, proactive promotion of getting people to the water, as Gail said earlier, and for all the reasons that Billy just laid out. So, you know, our expectation is that the department's actions over the next year or so is going to go, I mean, it'll have to obviously center on the rules, but that those rules need to be broad, and they're probably going to be somewhat unique in some of the ways that you're going to use them to be consistent and compliant with what this law requires of you. But having said that, I think, you know, we could also go back to a time, when I think the department was much more empowered to be proactive and supportive of public access. So if you look back at the 2007 rules, I mean, I was trying to figure out where all the rule changes have been, but I think those were the ones that actually had a lot of positive, proactive elements that used the department's authority in a way to promote the public's interest in public access, right? So obviously the downside for the last couple sets of iterations on these rules has been this idea that, you know, if there was an existing public access there now, for across great swaths of the regulatory actions the department took, there were no new access provided, right? So with all those standards that are in K, in section K, the current rules about, you know, commercial development, new commercial development being defined in such a way that you can do lots and lots of work and redevelopment work on a parcel of land as long as you look outside of that parcel or exceed very high impervious cover limits, you were exempted from having to provide public access. So the rules before were exactly the opposite of that, right? They looked at every opportunity except for the most minor maintenance activities as an opportunity for the state to leverage the provision of public access. And I think that's where this rule needs to go back to. I think that's what this law clearly envisioned for you. That's what all of our expectations are. We'll definitely work towards giving you very, very specific recommendations around the two questions you added to that. Right? You can go back and, I don't know whether the right approach is to go back and say, well, here was a good rule in 2007 where it defined what access should be provided, or to go to the current rule and say, you know, this is what needs to be removed, these very high hurdles, these very high thresholds, these exclusions for public access. I haven't been going through them. Staff has been helpful in trying to figure out where those archives are, where those little copies of the rules are. But the Literal Society, and, you know, we, as Greg said earlier, we've been really relying on and leaning on everybody's very real experiences with this stuff to help shape comments. And we'll try to get something very specific back to you around that idea. But again, I think, you know,
the connection and the very explicit requirements that will often review the funding. So whether that's Green Acres, Blue Acres, iBank, the federal nourishment, the short protection dollars, the short protection fund itself, to ensure that that is providing access and promoting it and maximizing it. Is going to be a really important tool in addition to the regulatory processes that you're going to work on over the next year and a half or so. And I think that's going to allow us to get around a lot of those problems that you can't get at through regulation, right? There's a need for planning, and that planning can't all happen at the municipal level, although that's one of those sort of loaded metaphor, one of those Russian dolls, right, with lots of different levels in it. Municipalities ought to be positively promoting it. They should be meeting statewide requirements that are a baseline, that are articulated in this rule, that they can't go below. The decision making should be delegated to them. The idea that the quote unquote character of community can influence how much access could happen. I think she did a very small role in that. But there needs to be statewide planning or regional planning. The Harbor Estuary Program did a really great study about public access and looked at some of the equity issues, particularly from the urban communities, about where folks were demographically, economically, in relationship to their ability to access the harbor in this case, right, or the northern waters of the city. And so the law talks about equitable distribution of access. The Harbor Estuary, the Waterfront Alliance, there's very talented planners in that. The department has those folks as well that can do that kind of analysis that should be used to inform where investments are being made. So that's and then that should be tied back in the rule to the review of the funding sources, right? So something similar, perhaps, to how you utilize the federal consistency process, where you look at something and say, this is what has to happen, and they get compliant with the rules. Standards. We think there ought to be a statewide minimum standard. The commissioner said precedent a couple weeks ago that she thought every quarter mile was pretty good. We haven't, I understand and recognize the value of consistency with the core standards depicted on the federal projects, but if there's rules in this that say that existing access, such as the street ends, that fall in between those every half mile formal, perhaps more developed access points are protected and maintained through conservation easements that run perhaps to third parties somehow, so that the shenanigans like the borough deal, let's sell off the street end for $1 million to a homeowner who wants to build a big house, don't happen. That may be appropriate, right? So the standard law should set a floor and a consistent minimum, should be flexible enough to recognize that where there's existing access, that existing access needs to be protected, and the rules need to do that. And whether they do that through the state aid agreements with the beach nourishment projects or other mechanisms, that's something that we're going to continue to explore as well. Let's see, what else? The idea of reasonable access, right? I don't think that, and I'll only speak for myself, but others may have different opinions about this. There clearly are lots and lots of activities that the department reviews through the regulatory program that would be very burdensome to try to assess when access should happen. So that parallel process you talked about, that work group at the beginning of it, I think is a reasonable approach. I think single family houses don't necessarily have to provide access every time they interact with your regulatory program. But the caution there is we have big stretches of the coastline that are dominated by single family houses. So what's the alternative to providing the public with access through those unbroken walls of houses? So you have to figure that out as the trade-off for requiring the regulatory program to provide that access. And maybe that's where there's the best impacts to the use of shore protection funds, it gave you an opportunity to do that. And then parking and bathrooms. I mean, first off, I think you clearly have the authority under this law now to go back with municipalities and eliminate the nonsense around residents-only parking, limited-time parking, not just through the city agreements anymore, but through sort of more direct authority. There may need to be acquisition by part of the state of lands to provide parking in places that good planning and forms as is needed to make sure that people, as you said, can get to the water. And that's going to be, there's no reason why we shouldn't have a suite of tools that are drawn on, whether those are regulatory exactions or investments made or carve-outs, so to speak, within public funding, reconstruction of highways. You know, the one I drive by all the time, of course, is Seabright. And, I mean, how many times has the state of New Jersey rebuilt Route 36 and never acquired a couple of parcels of land between Sandy Hook and the municipal parking lot to provide places for people to park? So, I understand that was not the policy of the last administration, but hopefully the department will see in this law that that's the deal with the intention was. Bathrooms are a tougher lift. I think when you look at access around sort of what's supporting local needs, what's supporting regional needs, what's supporting statewide needs, we'll have some indications as to where that can happen. Star Ledger did, everybody.com did everybody a favor the other day and ran an article about where they were. They went out and inventory bathrooms. So they say they did some work in the last couple weeks of the summer. But, I think, obviously, we're going on a lot about this, but I do think overwhelmingly the expectation is that, the department has been taking a very proactive, assertive, ambitious approach to public access, not act like it's something painful that has to be accommodated in the rest of your day-to-day business. And then just lastly on the enforcement questions, clearly the Raleigh decision gave you power over the fees and misuse of the fees, the nonsense about Pine Beach charging you to go fishing in the state waters in New Jersey, requiring badges, so that's going to have to be addressed. In the Public Access Task Force that Senator Smith pulled together, we had a lot of discussion about third-party rights and enforcement. It didn't make it in this bill, but as you know, the Senator keeps talking about Public Access Bill number two. I hope that the department does indeed really step up its enforcement actions. You should not be shy about letting all of us know, so we can advocate for the resources to be able to do that. But it really is, planning and regulations without enforcement of your stances. So I think you see that through all those examples that George mentioned. Thanks.
Thanks.
Short answer.
Nope. All right, so there was a couple of items we wanted to go over with everyone, which we think we're, hopefully everyone's on the same page of, and if we're not, we want to make sure we understand your position. We are envisioning a rule that still keeps the Hudson River waterfront walkway standards in that rule. We want to see people, if they're applying for a permit, there is no walkway in front, that is what they do, not choose a suite of other items and possibly go off site. So I think we're all in agreement on that. Yes, right, okay.
Question on
yes, sir.
When you said that there is not another walkway, there wasn't a walkway in front, are you talking about a walkway between the property and the beach?
No, I'm talking about along the Hudson River waterfront area.
Right.
If there is a new development going in and there is no portion of the walkway there, that their obligation is to provide the walkway as their public access amenity.
Yes. All right. Okay. Thank you very much. And I think that's state statute and then another statute.
Yes, sir.
That's
just as I said before, the walkway is largely built. It's about 90% complete between Jersey City and Fort Lee.
Yes.
The number of new construction where there's no walkway, very few, still a few less. The real issue is redevelopment, where there was an old walkway or an old easement, and the rules need to address that. I know I said it earlier, I just want to bring it back.
I heard that loud and clear. I'm just talking about for new, where there's no walkway. We don't want them to choose a parking area or a restroom. We want to keep it very black and white, new development, where there's no walkway, they have to adhere to those standards. But if there is an existing walkway, we heard your comments that perhaps they should be hitting the refresh button and looking at the walkway itself and anything additional needed to address the law. Yes?
Yeah, I think this raises a good question and a good analog to the new statute. With Hudson River waterfront area, it seems to me that the DEP got a statute and wrote rules about it and then thought that was the limits of its ability to enforce the public trust doctrine. And I'm afraid that that same thing is going to happen here. So in the Hudson River area, you have places that haven't applied for any permit and consequently don't have a walkway. But the DEP has the power and authority in the public trust doctrine to sue those places for keeping people out of public trust lands. But it's chosen not to do that because they're like, we got the statute, we got this rule. And so I think when we're also talking about enforcement, when we're having new rules come up about the rather limited authority that the state has given you, you run the danger of overlooking the existing common law remedies that you have under the public trust doctrine because you're waiting for people to apply for permits rather than proactively going over places where you have the authority to regulate, or not regulate, but enforce already.
Yeah, I think I heard that. I think the rest of my team heard that. You're looking for enforceability beyond just a permitting somebody who didn't build what they were supposed to build.
I'm not looking for it. I mean, you have it.
In our rule proposal, you would like to see us add that in there. I understand what you're saying. Today, we have that.
I don't know that it's appropriate in the rule proposal. It's an existing enforcement power that you guys are not using to most of our satisfaction. And what I hear from the DEP is that they're not enforcing public trust doctrine cases because they're waiting for these rules to complete, and these rules don't even speak to that. So like, if you end up in a situation like with the Hudson River waterfront area, where you have a statute and you're only enforcing the statute, then you're gonna be doing that again here. We're gonna be waiting at least 2 years for you to start enforcement actions, and you don't need that because you have
that. What you're stating is, and what I've heard is, that's the first time I've heard our enforcement is not doing enforcement waiting for rules. No one from enforcement has ever said that to me in any conversation, so I'm not aware of that as the case, but I heard it today. So we'll go back to our enforcement. Beaches and dunes, we envision that if you're building and developing near a beach and a dune, you have to provide perpendicular access to the waterway, right? And then certain waterways, we also were considering always being the case, sort of larger water bodies like the Hudson River.
Can I jump in here real quick?
Yes, sir. Yeah, sure.
Certainly, beaches and dunes. I mean, I know at least three cases where beach replenishment was accomplished. One, I think, I believe it was Long Branch, where they went in and they bulldozed sand into dunes that were perpendicular to the ocean and put up fences, private beach, not fences, put up signs, private beach. I've seen photographs from Bayhead where after the beach replenishment is completed, homeowners have gone and extended snow fencing perpendicular to the ocean and put up signs. And if you go to Seaside Park where the Funtown Pier used to be, there is now a beach there that is, and it's under the footprint of the old Funtown Pier. But with the beach replenishment, that beach now extends further out into the ocean. There is no fencing up there perpendicular to the ocean, and it says private property, no trespassing. So I think we need clear definition of what becomes the public trust lands.
Yeah. So I don't want to spend a lot of time myself speaking because you brought up a lot of good points. We've been talking about these for the last probably 2 months. These issues that we do agree that there is clearly an educational campaign that has to happen. This session today, it's great. I think we've made more points of contact with individuals so we can get that information from. But yes, there clearly is problems out there that are not correct, that need to be corrected. Yes, sir. Glenn.
You've created and been recognized by the federal government your wonderful CIS map of public access points. From Elmer Run to Lock Arbor, which is my little area that I've been watching, it is not only inaccurate, but as I mentioned earlier, when it comes to beach replenishment, there is a section between the, I believe it's Valhalla, which is the side street on the west side of Ocean Avenue, that is listed on the map as a public access point, which, by the way, when you get to the bulkhead, your kids aren't going to be able to get off that down onto the beach, even with the replenishment that's been done. But it is 0.6 miles to Roosevelt Ave, which is the next real public access. You guys have Garfield Road, but that's not public access. That's easement for fishermen only, and yet you have it on the map. My questions are, what is the timetable for having that map updated? Who can give input to it, and what is necessary as far as the input?
I think, well, what you bring up, there was an individual who ran those public access, who did that map, worked with a bunch of interns, they truth checked those points. And Kim is recently, who's to my right here, her team has recently taken over that, and we recognize that those maps are not accurate. And in reality, probably should be taken down because they're that inaccurate in some locations. And we've heard a lot of complaints about them. But we do have a long-range strategy on how to handle that. But right now, our priority is to get this rule in some shape so that we meet the 18-month timeline, which we're already 2 months into. So,
one thing.
Yes, but we do recognize that the map is inaccurate.
I accept that. Mm-hmm. Don't take it down. You had it down for 7 years, or not quite seven, from just after Sandy until late last year, it didn't exist online. And all of a sudden, it was put back up. And it was put back up exactly the way it was before Sandy. Now, there have been a lot of repaired, there was a lot of damage, but a lot of that, especially in Elmer Run, has been repaired, but none of that's reflected. And I've been told when I called and tried to give input to it, I said, I can give you pictures.
We're happy to take them.
Yeah, well, but whoever was I talked to refused, so.
Yeah.
What am I going to do?
Yeah, I'm sorry you had that experience.
I'll be brief. I monitor the biting plovers. I'm a fisherman, other fishermen here, I monitor the biting plovers. I get a look. I volunteer. Through Fish and Wildlife. I'm a wilderness ambassador, I think it's called. But anybody knows me, I'm not diplomatic, so the ambassador doesn't quite apply. But the simple fact of the matter is, what about the idea of developing some type of a parallel program with Fish and Wildlife has, where volunteers go out and monitor these? You can come up with a checklist, you can get volunteers, you can vet them, you can give them the checklist to go out in the field, take a photograph, submit the information electronically, and you can be updating your information right away, or at least verifying that these points actually still exist.
Fish and Wildlife already has the program for multitude of different operations. I happen to be on one for artificial reefs, but because we didn't have funding for 11 to last year, there was nothing to do.
Okay. Tim?
So if I can go back to your, maybe this one segues into it, but look, when you frame that,
can you go back to the prior slide?
This one?
Right, yeah. So when you say certain waterways,
public trust applies to all tidally flowed and formerly tidally flowed lands, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and to a pretty great extent, the statutes that are touched on by this law also go in those areas. So you're not thinking of excluding certain areas except
for... No, maybe I need to better explain this slide, or this particular provision we had on there. So in 2007, in the rules, there was a provision that single-family homeowners didn't have to provide public access except if they were immediately adjacent to a beach and dune and certain waterways, it had to be addressed. That's what that's about.
Okay.
Was there something along those same lines that people were looking for? Certain waterways that there should be, under no circumstances, a pass.
Right.
So I wanted to jump ahead because we don't have that much more time left. So we talked a little bit, not too many people, because I heard it certainly was an opportunity for us to hear of the continual problems with access to with respect to parking, with respect to restrooms, with respect to just getting to areas. Certainly heard that pretty clearly today. But going back to the goal of the stakeholder session is really to look at the legislation to see if there are certain circumstances that you see that a change in a footprint might be so minimal that you don't think that we should do this individualized assessment. Let's say a person was getting an individual permit and they're moving their house landward, or they're putting a swing set in front of their home, or a pool. Something that triggers a need to get a permit. Remember, under the upland waterfront development law, you touch the ground, you need a permit. You do geotechnical borings, you need a permit. And we also recognize that through the course of the years of this law, there has been these pendulum swings back and forth with court challenges. Not to say that we're going to get it right. I'm sure somebody's not going to be happy. But we're looking at, Kim started in the Orange Book. Anybody knows anything about our coastal program, that's where it all started, is the Orange Book. And it's, travel down this journey, her and her team, of what we've done and trying to look at them and see if there are gems still in there that we want to extract out, but also want to be reasonable, because we recognize when we start to be unreasonable, that's when legislation comes out, that's when court challenges happen. And ringing in my head, Tim, was when we did that webinar, Senator Smith sitting next to me saying, well, I hope the DEP is reasonable. And I thought, what is he trying to get at? I'm going to have to, I'm not going to have to guess.
To Senator Smith, and he said it was what we were saying. That's exactly what he meant, was reasonable, the other day.
Okay, yeah, that's so what he meant. Okay, all right.
But you have to be careful, because reasonableness is also defined in the court cases in New Jersey, too. Mm-hmm. But the one thing I wanted to say, I wanted to pick up on what Tim said earlier. I think when you look at the permitting, in some cases you may want to go down to some of the more minor permits if it's an area where there is no access, versus if there's already access, it may not matter. If somebody's putting a deck on their house or elevating or whatever you want to do, and there's access within a couple of, within a block or two, I can see not, doing anything there. But if it's one of those places where there's a mile of walled off, McMansions along, up on stilts, and someone's doing something, then maybe there may make sense. So I think that's why I think having planning and rules in place may help determine that.
Yeah. What about an idea of, now we don't know if we can do this, there certainly is a legal examination that we have to do, if there was an ability to have a fund for maybe these smaller sites, the money to go into this fund, and then that fund be used in that community to provide, kind of make up that inability to get access to the water, or an amenity such as parking or restrooms or changing rooms, depending upon the location. What do people think about that idea for off-site as a possible suite of options if we're legally allowed to do that? Yes, Tony.
A couple of comments that I hope will bring us point is, one is I think that, I guess I do think the concept of incentives such that particular community scale that communities can use to work with individual site folks to make it make sense, I think certainly should be considered, because I think that's where you're going to hopefully bridge concerns at NJAC and individual permit owners and so might. So I think incentives and thinking like that not really should. I actually just want to make a point, two quick points, that when you look at reasonability, it's not only about the burden and the impact on the individual permittee, but reasonable from the perspective of what the objectives and goal of the law are. And so I think clearly thinking a little bit more about, as people sort of jump back and forth between public access and public trust, as if somehow they're the same thing, they're very different things that are related. And so I do think, again, we have a pretty good publication we put out 2 years ago on a citizen's guide to the public trust and public access, which I would recommend for the people to share with their communities if you want to have some specific discussions, because I feel like what I'm not hearing as clearly is how the rules might set out clearly standards and criteria, the extent to which public access advances the state's goals of ensuring public trust amenities, fishing, recreation purposes. So criteria and standards with regard to affirmative objectives to enhance not only the traditional recreational framework that New Jersey is a leader on in the public trust framework, and it's clearly within both your rulemaking and I think the state's interest, but also thinking more broadly, which is now added in this legislation about natural resource values and benefits, environmental sustainability and resilience, which are two components that I think are recognized in the law. So I do think, again, I understand why you come at this from a what's the trigger from a burden, reasonable from a burden on the individual permit framework. Mm-hmm. No way to get away from that. You need to be reasonable there, but I also think that you'll be better positioned to be reasonable there if you're clear as you can be in your stance about what you're trying to advance from a criteria and standards view with regard to the public trust objectives that you're furthering through the access rules. So that's something that I think give some consideration to, because I think those criteria might help you then think through where the standards might be and under what circumstances you might have incentives that are beyond the individual limit that might try to advance that. And there was one final point or other point that I wanted to make a little bit is, again, I also feel like, you know, just do thinking about always keeping in mind there's a tendency to talk about the beaches all the time because that's, you know, the amount. And again, I do think this idea of individualized access and people's right, the public's right to access the waterways more generally and access the water, just let's keep that in mind, because I feel like maybe that gets lost a little bit. You know, it's a lot of what I do and a big focus of the work that we do. But I do feel like we need to think about the other waterways pretty significantly. And lastly, the point I was hemming to remind myself of is, I guess I'm a question in my mind when I think about things like the traditional look back at what we've done right and wrong around Hudson Waterfront and others, about there will be significant investment over in the coming years to adaptation strategies. And thinking about, not that maybe you make Dave Rosenblatt will do this, but thinking a little bit more about how you anticipate in your public access rules the fact that there will be investment in infrastructure along the coast, and how you think that, again, there are a lot of folks thinking about designing those things for multiple purposes and thinking about how you increase the public trust amenities through those investments. So again, probably beyond the scope of what you're doing, but I think some consideration of that is certainly worthwhile given where I think a lot of the money will be in investing in adaptation, both in natural features as well as hard features in the future. So that's just another
thing. Where does that document you talk about reside?
If you look at the Urban Coast Institute website and look at the Public Trust Public Access Guide.
What was the name of the organization?
I think
Tony, would you like us to send that out?
Yeah, I'll send it.
We have that link, don't we?
Yeah.
We can send it out to the stakeholders on your behalf.
Great, thanks.
It's a great opinion.
As per the concept of, you said establishing funds in towns in order, or in communities, to be able to dip into those funds in order to be able to, I think, provide access is what you're really talking about.
Not really sure how we're going to administer the money out of the fund. That's like a grant program, certainly only good players should be able to get grant money, things like that, but
You don't want to be, basically you have a Green Acres program that you can refer to in terms of doing that. And Green Acres has some pretty strict rules about how you reattach certain values to pieces of property, and that you have to give up property if you want to get that property back. And that communities basically, as soon as they're in the Green Acres program, all their properties in the Green Acres program and things like that. So you're not, you know, there are other things, as were mentioned, that you can actually tap into that are already there.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to emphasize the concept of making this look, not only look, but be positive,
mm-hmm.
and that people recognize that what we're really trying to do here is have a I love New Jersey concept,
mm-hmm.
in terms of, or I love to fish in New Jersey, or I like to recreate New Jersey, so that people don't see this as being a hand slapping situation.
Mm-hmm.
I had one other thing that I wanted to mention that I didn't bring up before, but the availability of public access shouldn't be determined by this clock. It should be determined by the tide clock. And fishermen, especially striper fishermen, get some of the best fishing in at night. And it's really makes it very hard for fishermen to get to the water if they close the public access at 6 o'clock in the evening, because that's when people should be home.
That's it. And I forgot to do that. It's like,
I'm a fisherman.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do it that much as I used to, but I'm a fisherman. And I'm a member of the Hudson River Fishermen's Association. I can tell you that nothing is more disappointing than to get a couple of guys together to go out fishing and get to the point where you're going to fish and find out that there's a gate and a lock that says it's closed at 6 p.m. or 8 p.m. Some other brochure.
Not dusk.
You know?
Yeah,
it's dusk. And that makes it a moving target.
How do you enforce that law? How do you enforce dusk? Right.
You get the local cop to
surfing can also be wind and tide specific. So in terms of towns like Point Pleasant, where you have them turn in the beach access over to Jenkinson, and allowing them to enforce this like a 6 p.m. time limit where you can't get to the beach when there's no light until 8:30, and you may have a favorable tide or favorable wind and you want to get to that spot. And also, there are a lot of towns that only allow swimming during the day, and you can't surf until after hours or before their hours, so timing restrictions is definitely something that we look at.
As far as the access on timing, diving, we go whenever we want, because we don't really care so much about tide. Tides, yeah, okay, yeah, get a better overhead when the tide is high, but the water's still there when the tide is low. Our problem is a little more local. We have towns that it's not an overt prohibition, prohibiting diving, but when we do dive off the shore, we have to worry about not only the safeties of diving, but also the fact that our brothers here, fishermen, have been there before us and leave things behind occasionally when the line breaks. And we get entangled. And one of the things that the towns have prevented us from diving is saying no weapons on the beach. We have to cross that beach to get in, but we need a knife or a pair of scissors to untangle ourselves from what's left behind. Now, the other thing I have up there on a previous slide was your half-mile limit of access. That precedent has been set by the Army Corps of Engineers in their regulations. And their teeth is, their enforcement of that is by saying, well, if you don't allow access every half mile, we're going to charge you more to get your sand. Now, if you're going to set up that same that same half-mile limit, what teeth are you going to put in the regulations for enforcement of that half-mile limit? Because with the Army Corps, it's going to cost your taxpayers more money, but is the state going to say the same thing, that we're going to rely on the Army Corps to enforce it? Or are you going to put something in there other than just a permit that says, yes, you must have access every half mile, and this is what's going to happen if you don't?
Thank you.
So on the other list of public access, I think sort of on the flip side, there's a positive nature of where there is public programming or stewardship on those public access sites. So there's a way to recognize, and there's a number of groups around the table that provide great public programming. Municipalities do as well, and that really, in a lot of cases, it's not just simply with physical access, right? It's inviting people to walk beyond the sound.
Hold on just a second.
Yeah.
Can you guys, if you're going to talk about that, I'm sorry, I was getting distracted.
Yeah. So I think just recognizing public programming that's provided, whether it's through nonprofit or municipality or state, and that's sort of a positive feature as opposed to a limited public access, being able to recognize where that is being done, and if there's a way to recognize where the private sector individual can contribute to that effort as a way of providing access. And then on the previous slide, the half mile access, just I didn't just mention before, but we did a survey of where, from an equity point of view and population density point of view, there was not enough public access. And certainly the state has a number of criteria it uses for distressed communities or just population density, so it's not simply a half mile, it's recognizing that there's more people on the waterfront that want to go there.
So maybe that half mile might work in a beach scenario, but not in an urban area, so you bring it.
Some of us would like to go to the 07 rule, where it was a quarter mile. The half mile access could really mean a mile, especially in a lot of small towns, like you go to Long Beach Island, and I like Tim's suggestion, if there's existing access, why not keep it? Mm-hmm. And if you have these street ends that really are public easements going into the beach, that's another potential point. But I wanted to address the on-site results. I think having a funding mechanism to do that would be a good thing. The question where you get the money from would become a fee on permits and CAFRA, which might be a good way of doing penalties for those places like your auto dealership that's got the gate, or whatever. No, that's not what we're talking about. That's why you cast it. You've always been in the shadow, don't you? But, or come up with using the penalties, but you do need that kind of mechanism. And again, I think there are towns that would help, provide these things. And going back to the amenities, I think also, there are towns that have facilities that are underutilized. I do a lot of inland hiking, and we work a lot with some of the churches and up in the Highlands that have their bathrooms and parking areas available on Saturdays and Sundays after Mass for hikers to park there and use the bathroom. So some towns could do that, or work with the local churches, or work with the town. Some of the town's missile buildings 2 blocks from the beach. They're not open on the weekends, so as we all know, you can't get beach passes then. But why not park there and have their facilities open? So I think there are ways of getting to those points.
Yeah. Can you add something you wanted to say?
Sure. Well, just was a little bit earlier about.
I thought you were sort of suggest, but are there places where on-site access might not be required? Fairly small and constrained places like lagoon communities.
Yeah.
And then how would that be offset, whether it's through a contribution or a mitigation fund? I think that's actually something the department should pursue, because the problem all too often with good ideas for us is how we implement it, right? So the idea of offsite mitigation is an appropriate idea in places where you could put a really nice public access site just at the end of the row of houses. It would be better than trying to cram it into the individual houses. But the problem with the last rule was that it left that to municipalities who then started trying to push it out of their town, up the waterway, back up into Newark, wherever that they thought it was going to be least intrusive on their particular citizens. So, But to the contrary, then, but it, or on the other side of that coin, the department did really good things when you required off-site mitigation for facilities that couldn't accommodate for some reason in the past, whether it was homeland security. Don't necessarily have the option this time around, but so again, the department was to be the person identifying where those facilities could be and built, and then bringing shore protection funds into it, Green Acres funds into it, Blue Acres funds to tap into the resiliency relationship. That's probably not a bad idea. Whether there's some mechanism that you can geographically identify small stretches of the coastline that qualifying sort of these limited places that we're going to address this in this way rather than through the permit process. I think that's a kind of interesting idea. Just to be clear, though, that we're never talking about restricting the public's rights to use the public trust area itself for waters, the type of flow areas. It's talking about perpendicular access or places that might, in other circumstances, meet Matthew's tests or others. No.
Hello? Yeah.
Anyway, right at the beginning of your monologue there, I heard the words lagoons, and it reminded me of years ago, I used to spend vacation time down at Ocean Beach, outside of Ottawa. And all of that land is previously built by.
Sure.
So the Ocean Beach Quad, so to speak, which is what they call it,
right,
they have a responsibility.
Absolutely.
And they have private beach clubs.
And just like Hudson River Walkway, they have a remaining obligation to honor the public trust, right?
Right.
But where do you do it? I think I thought was the question Ginger was asking. Do you try to get it on the backs of, Senator Smith and his neighbor's property? Is it allowed to let there? Or do you create a little park at the end of that street or at the causeway, make sure there's a fishing access at the bridge? Which is not going to get done by the homeowners, it's going to have to get done by some other third party.
Right.
But they should chip in.
More meaningful.
Yeah.
Access.
A lot of the homeowners associations, though, they have clubhouses on the bay,
right,
and you have to have a beach badge from that particular club in order to use that beach.
Well, but see, there's a remedy, right, is to remove that restriction. And we're saying that when the bass are running past that point, George wants to go down and fish from it, he's allowed to.
Sure.
So that's a fairly simple fix.
Okay. Yeah, right.
I want to make two comments on enforcement, two suggestions. One is the question of follow-up on a permit that's issued. Permits are issued with all kinds of conditions. But right now, there's no follow-up as to whether those conditions are actually implemented. And ideally, the DEP would have the resources to go inspect them all. Well, that's not going to happen. Is there any way we can put some kind of closeout certification or some document from the builder that says, I did it all, that if he lies to you, the penalties are significant? Some way that there's feedback that these things, in fact, have been done. Maybe there's other ways. But right now, it's an open-ended thing, and we never know whether they, in fact, do what the permit implies. Same thing with recording public access easements. We have several cases where the public access easement was never recorded and therefore isn't enforceable. And so that's one. The other one is, maybe it's not possible legally, but right now the burden of proof is entirely on the DEP to go prove that there is a violation. And no matter how much evidence that we can provide the DEP that shows a violation, for example, pictures and videos of a wedding being held in the middle of the walkway with signs of walkway closed, the DEP can't use that. The DEP says we have to go out and physically see it ourselves. At least the enforcement people that I work with will not accept any evidence from us or anyone else without seeing it themselves. And the restaurants know that. The restaurants routinely close the walkway for activities on Saturdays and Sundays because there's no enforcement. I don't know what can be done to allow other evidence to be brought to the DEP that they can use it to bring enforcement action.
On the timing restrictions, that's kind of a slippery slope because very simply, that is one of the most covert ways that towns will block access. I've served for 50 years. I've only been a saltwater fisherman for about 10 years. You know, they've been, I paddled out at dawn with my kids. It's the greatest time in the world to be on the ocean surfing. I've been on the beach with friends fishing early in the morning. I'll be out there before dawn because of the fact that I know the fish are going to be out there. I get to see the sunrise come up. I get to spend the time with my friends. And timing restrictions are that thing where, well, fishermen are noisy, fishermen are dirty, fishermen litter, fishermen urinate in the street. Well, guess what? The speed limit on my street is 25 miles an hour. If you go more than 25 miles an hour, you can be written a ticket. Nobody wants to see me pursue the fishermen, or the anglers, I should say, so we include everybody. Nobody wants to see me go out there and enforce the existing laws. They'd rather just cut us all off because it's palatable, is that word again, to the homeowner. They get rid of us, shoo, 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 and away we go. So timing restrictions, they can pull the security cord all they want. You know what? In October, the security concerns are gone when all the tourists have gone home.
Getting back to enforcement and the enforcement concepts that you were talking about, I was a police commissioner for several years in my town. Police officers are, in general, have a lot more responsibilities than just the fact of going out and writing tickets and doing things like that. For example, police officers can work with the school system. They have DAR programs. They have a lot of different programs. It's quite possible that you can have a police officer who is apprised of the law and the DEP and be a spokesperson or capable of enforcing DEP laws or regulations in that community with the proper training. The idea is that what happens to several of the people in my organization is we'll get a call from somebody, and somebody will call me and say, "Hey, Gil, what happened in Weehawken?" I said, "Why? What happened in Weehawken, for example?" "Well, we tried to get out to the water, and we couldn't get out to the water. And then a guy called the police, and the police came and said, well, there's a no trespassing sign, so you should get off the water." If there was somebody in that police department that had the capability of understanding the law, then you might be able to say, "No, that's wrong." That, you know, it's a lot of education in the situation that could actually work.
That was just about here with Bosch Hill thoughts. They had the green police program that they tried to get started, which Hill was commissioner. And that's where they train local.
The green police program would have trained local police officers to help you guys enforce your rules and regulations. Right now, you know, when you talk to the local police, you know, they're very much involved in traffic and quality of life crimes. And, you know, when it comes to the environment, they'll walk right past a blatant environmental violation in order to get to somebody who might be dog parked. You know, like, they have to have their priorities straightened out. And I think it's a way to do it, but it didn't work then. But somebody might want to look at that and figure out why it didn't work and what we can do to make it work the next time.
So we're going to be wrapping up. It's 3:00. What next steps? So I heard from several different people. I would like to send you our thoughts. We're going to consider this to be an active dialogue. You have Jill's email address. She sent the original invite out. If you have any additional information you want to add, we are reading through all documents people sent to us, assessing them. As I said, we're going to regroup again. We will have a work group, at least one work group. Maybe a second one after I talk to my team here, we might also do. And definitely heard a lot of conversation about enforcement, so that was really helpful. We appreciate those his thoughts, and I appreciate the PowerPoint. This is great. And he just left, right, gentlemen? He stepped aside. This great PowerPoint has really good information that we can sit down and have a really good conversation with our enforcement team. So as I mentioned to you briefly in the beginning, we do have a multi-pronged approach to this. We are looking at an educational campaign. We found it's when we started to tally up what we had heard from people, working with our AG's office on appropriate responses, and pretty much almost like a script that we would share with all our municipalities, and then an educational campaign with them on what is allowed, what isn't. And then also, for myself, I had a great education talking to Dave Rosenblatt on some things that I didn't know. Like when we place sand on the private beach clubs, those beach clubs are now open to the public, and that you just have to be able to, they can charge you for a badge, no more than what they owner. So there's more in that that we need to make sure it gets out there to the public so they better understand. So the more of us that are using the same script, viewing things from the same lens, perhaps we can reduce some of these conflicts and get at what you said, sir, which is celebrating our coastal resources, which we have such a great amenities here in the state of New Jersey. So thank you all for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Tim, make sure you're on that work.
Yeah, I was
I don't know if anyone asked.
Okay.
Because I was on your phone.
Oh, yeah.
You're like 5 minutes.